In the fall of 1777 in Saratoga, New York, gentleman Johnny Burgoyne led the skilled British and German forces in an attempt to separate rebellious New England from other colonies. They faced off against the inexperienced and improvised American army led by Horatio Gates and were handed an utterly stunning defeat. The stark fact was that one of the world's finest armies had been beaten by a band of amateurs. The two battles fought at Saratoga, Freeman's Farm and Bemis Heights, marked a turning point in the Revolutionary War when it became apparent that American independence was inevitable. The new book, 1777, Tipping Point at Saratoga, by Dean Snow, narrates in detail the final 33 days of the Saratoga campaign, where British and German troops, despite their initial advantage in skill and training, endured inadequate supplies and thinning ranks, and were eventually and astoundingly defeated. Dean Snow is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Penn State University and past President of the Society for American Archaeology, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Very nice to have you on the program. So what is a nice archaeologist doing writing a book about Saratoga?
I did some archaeology at the battlefield to help get them ready for the bicentennial way back in the 1970s. And that produced an enduring interest in the battles and the archaeological consequences of two armies living and fighting over the course of about 32 days on that piece of upstate New York landscape. And I thought for many years of writing a book, but it wasn't until just the last 3 years that I finally had the time to give it that it really deserved.
What is it that archaeology can tell us about the battlefield, about that place?
Well, I was asked to undertake that project to begin with because they weren't absolutely sure at the time that they had properly located the British fortifications. These had been mapped by a British officer at the time, but the map was inaccurate in several ways. And so there were doubts about the locations that they had laid out on the landscape, and they wanted to make sure that it was as accurate as possible, especially since they were expecting a lot of visitors during the bicentennial years. So our objectives were principally in the early 70s to rediscover, define, and explore in detail the British fortifications and the ways in which they had been constructed, and to be absolutely sure that we knew exactly where on the landscape the action had taken place.
I assume that any history that you're going to read about Saratoga obviously is going to have Benedict Arnold and Gates and Burgoyne as the main characters. But you really expand that. There is a whole really interesting cast of characters here that play very large roles in this story.
Yes, that's true. Most books that cover the Saratoga campaign necessarily cover much more time than I have because they have to cover the campaign from start to finish. They also need to tell the story very often at sort of an airline 30,000 foot level and focus frequently on just the main players, the generals who made the decisions. I decided that I wanted to do something more intimate, partly because I'm an archaeologist, and when we work on a little patch of ground, we do so with a great deal of detailed precision, and that's because anything we dig up is gone forever, and we're destroying part of the record as we work through it. So we've got to do it right, and we've got to be very, very particular about how we do it. And what that does is it gives us a very kind of personal, intimate look at what went on in the past. And when I read through the journals and the letters and the publications that followed the battles, I also became much more interested in the individuals who had been there and done that. And they told their stories very much like the World War II veterans that I knew growing up and in more recent years. That whole generation is leaving us now. And it really struck me that the way in which they thought about what they did and the history of World War II was at a very intimate level, and I decided to try to capture that in this book.
Capturing the Battle of Bemis Heights, give us a sense of what brought us to that point and what ultimately happened on that day.
Well, the British, particularly in this case John Burgoyne, had decided that they could profit from separating the New England colonies, which they regarded as the most difficult and rebellious of the colonies, from the rest of the colonies. And that meant specifically separating New England from New York and the other mid-Atlantic colonies. So they decided that they could drive southward from Montreal and, with any luck, northward at the same time from New York City, which they occupied, and converge on Albany and set up a string of garrisons up and down the Hudson and up and down Lake Champlain to prevent the New Englanders from interacting with the rest of the colonies. This could also be enforced because they had the British Navy focused on New York City at the time, and they thought that they could keep the colonies split in this way. So it seemed like a good idea at the time, as all ideas do, and they came south from Montreal with a force of over 9,000 men under Burgoyne's command. They had tried to send another force through Fort Stanwix and down the Mohawk River, but that was turned back. And it turned out that General Howe decided to take most of his men that were in New York southward into New Jersey, leaving the garrison in New York too small to make any effective push up the Hudson River towards Albany. So Burgoyne found himself on his own. And the farther south he got, the fewer supplies he had and the more men he lost. Whereas the Americans facing him, the Northern Army under the command of Horatio Gates, got stronger and stronger as they retreated towards Albany, moving very carefully and making it very difficult for the British all along the way. They found more and more men coming into camp, and they found more and more supplies being sent north from Albany. So the Americans got stronger, the British got weaker as the summer turned into fall, and by the time they got to October, it was do or die for Burgoyne.
Tell us, as you write in this book, about British Brigadier General Simon Fraser, who is mortally wounded. How did that happen, and what are some of the misconceptions about his death, or about his about his injury?
That might be the most controversial aspect of this book. For many years, since the early 1800s, the shot that killed Simon Fraser, or mortally wounded him, he died the next day, has been attributed to Timothy Murphy, one of Morgan's riflemen, and a guy from Schoharie Valley, so he was a local guy. None of that attribution surfaced until after Murphy's death in the 1800s, and it was in the 1840s that a local historian made the assertion that Murphy had shot Simon Fraser. There was, at the same time, however, an eyewitness account that was published, I think first in the Saratoga newspaper, of an Albany militiaman actually firing the shot that wounded Simon Fraser. So that's the tack that I've taken in this book. I've used that source, and I think that some people will object to my dismissal of Timothy Murphy, but that's the way history works. There are reasons why historians sort of got in line and repeated that over the years, but I think that you can make a much stronger case for the anonymous militiaman from Albany having done the deed.
What happened to his remains?
Well, he was buried the next day at sunset on the hill overlooking the Hudson River. We investigated in 1973 the location of that grave and located it, but discovered that it was empty. There was one source that indicated that the British, after their surrender, had stopped by the burial site and discovered to their horror that the grave had been opened. But it wasn't clear from that document whether they thought that Simon Fraser was still buried there or not. What we discovered was that the grave was empty. We don't know who took up the body or why, but there was a lot of talk at the time about the British having buried their payroll, and there were a lot of people running around seeing if they could find where that had been buried. So perhaps that's what they were looking for. In any case, it's an enduring mystery. Nobody knows quite what happened to Simon Fraser's body, but the grave was empty.
Dean Snow is our guest. The name of the new book is 1777, Tipping Point at Saratoga. You do write about, of course, Benedict Arnold and the decision by Major General Horatio Gates to remove Arnold from his command between the two battles at Saratoga. Give us a sense of what led to that and what was going on in the background.
Well, Arnold had a mercurial and narcissistic personality. It made him difficult to get along with. If there was a lull in the conversation, he would jump into it. He always had a strong point of view. He always had an opinion. He was sometimes wrong, but he was never in doubt, and this made him hard to live with for everyone. And it was noted. This was a these characteristics were noted by both Gates and other officers in the American Army. And during the first battle, the Battle of Freeman's Farm, he had gone off more or less on his own hook. The problem there was that Gates really wanted to stay within, as much as he could, within the fortifications that had been laid out, designed, and constructed, at least partially constructed, by Thaddeus Kosciuszko. And he thought that was the best way in which he could fight that battle. He wanted to do it defensively, particularly since he was dealing with so much inexperience on the American side, and the British Army was very, very good, as you pointed out, perhaps the best in the world at the time. So he wanted to fight a defensive battle. Arnold just took it out, took on his own preference, and started committing regiment after regiment to the fighting way forward of the American lines in a place where Gates really didn't want the fight to take place. So at the end of that battle, Gates was very, very angry with Arnold and determined to get rid of him. He never really formally removed Arnold from command, so Arnold remained in camp despite having asked for a pass to go to Philadelphia. He remained there and was still around when the second battle erupted a little over 2 weeks later.
You write a great deal about the technology used in battle. Talk a little bit about that and the equipment that was used.
The guns that the Americans had, that is to say the firearms that the soldiers carried, were a hodgepodge of things. They were mostly muskets. The British had the Brown Bess musket, and all of them had basically the same musket. But and the Americans had whatever they happened to have available. The guy that shot Simon Fraser was probably firing a fowling piece, something that he would normally shoot with a buckshot to go when he went hunting for ducks or geese. But it would have been loaded that day with a single ball, probably. And the Americans also had the services of a crack corps of riflemen under the command of Daniel Morgan. Morgan later became a general himself and was brilliant at battles such as Cowpens down South Carolina. But at this time, in 1777, he was still a colonel commanding a bunch of riflemen. And these guys were really very good. The problem they had was that their rifles were designed as long-range hunting pieces, so they weren't designed to take bayonets, and they weren't designed to be loaded very rapidly. So they had to be supported by a contingent of light infantry so that they wouldn't get overrun by large numbers of British troops carrying muskets. It took a couple of minutes to reload a rifle. It only took 15 seconds to reload a musket. So the advantage of the rifle was you could shoot somebody 100 yards away. The disadvantage was that by the time you got it reloaded, had you missed on the first attempt, you'd probably be overrun by the people you were shooting at.
What was the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the surrender on October 17th?
Well, of course, the Americans had to escort an army of almost 6,000 men into captivity. That meant they had to escort this huge number of men down to Virginia, where they interned them. The officers in the British and the German contingents were taken mostly to Boston through Massachusetts, and eventually exchanged for American officers that had been captured. The aftermath for Albany was that they had a huge number of people from both armies that were being hospitalized there, including Benedict Arnold. These men had to be, mostly men, had to be hauled back to Albany in boats or in wagons in order to get them medical care there. And a large number of them died, of course, of their wounds, because in those days, wounds were often fatal. Wounds that we wouldn't consider to be life-threatening now were even fatal. So there was a lot of that sort of activity. There was, of course, a celebration in Albany because this was a huge victory. Right. Nothing like this had ever happened to the British Army before. This was the first time an entire army had had to surrender. And forcing the Americans to use the word convention instead of capitulation or surrender was just a tiny little compensation to the British for what had actually happened. We pretended that it wasn't really a surrender by using a different word, but everybody knew what it was.
After many years since you were working on the battlefield and doing the archaeology there, in the research of this book and doing this book, did you even find out more and answer questions that had been lingering for yourself?
Yeah, I think what I found out writing the book was what it was like for the people on both sides. And the British side had two components. There were Germans there and there were British soldiers there. And some of those British soldiers were, in fact, Irishmen and other people recruited from around northwestern Europe. So I got to know a lot of these people at a very personal level, and it made it hard to write from time to time. I would just have to stop early on some days because what was happening to these people that I was talking about was so hard to take. When you have boys really out there at the age of 15 and 16, being wounded multiple times and then dying in the hospital tent, and you can imagine boys that are like the ones that I have as students now, or like my son was when he was still a boy. I mean, this is hard to take stuff sometimes, but especially if you've decided to do this kind of intimate story, you're going to encounter those kinds of things, and so I found out a lot about the personalities of people who I didn't know very well at all, and most people had never heard of prior to writing the book.
As we wrap up, I'm curious as to your thoughts and what you make of the terrain of that area of Saratoga, right on the Hudson River, and for those of us who live close, which many of us in this region do. You can see it and picture it and sort of see the battle unfold in your imagination. Give us a sense of that terrain and how it played such an integral role into the battle.
Well, I've been lucky enough to spend time on some of the really magical spots on the face of the earth, and this is one of them. This is on my short list. Those bluffs above the Hudson are just an extraordinary place to spend time. I lived for 26 years just to a few miles away in Burnt Hills, New York, and so I know that countryside well. And that particular patch, the 5 square miles of the national park, is just an extraordinary spot, and I never can quite get enough of it. I'll go out, and a lot of people have said this, by the way. They go out there every day to do a little hike or just to sit and look. There are lots of people I've run into that share my view of that place. It's just a magical place. And if if you happen to be a local person and you haven't experienced it, you really deserve it, you owe it to yourself to go out there and spend some time and just get a feel for that terrain. The National Park Service is a remarkable agency, and they have done a terrific job maintaining that battlefield, and it is largely because of their efforts that it is what it is, and it truly is a magical place.
Absolutely. Dean Snow is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Penn State University and past president of the Society for American Archaeology. He's the author of the new book, 1777, Tipping Point at Saratoga, published by Oxford University Press. Dean Snow, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
It was a great pleasure for me, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, 1777, Tipping Point at Saratoga by Dean Snow. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.